Welcome to NextGen Mentoring Forum. The NextGen Mentoring Forum series is to empower, educate, and illuminate individuals who are in or interested in the financial planning profession. At each forum, an expert will discuss a topic in the field of financial planning with the purpose of inspiring critical thought and discussion. In today's session, I have the honor to interview Joel Franks on the topic of applying financial behaviors to build your wealth. My name is Dr. Jolly Jen. I am an assistant professor and director of financial planning program at California Lutheran University. I am a certified financial planner practitioner and maintain an active financial planning practice specializing in succession program management. I've authored 3 award-winning books. I am honored today to have Joel Franks with us today. Joel has diverse business roles and his strong financial marketing background has enabled him to combine both the science and the art of creating innovative storytelling that is relevant, engaging, and shareable. With extensive financial marketing experience in banking, investments and insurance, along with his behavioral finance and content marketing skills, he offers a unique perspective on financial literacy. Joel has proven a record of accomplishment in areas of marketing strategies, social media innovation, team building, partnership development, influential communications, and the ability to cultivate an organization's initiatives. He has an extensive knowledge and familiarity with a digital presence, public relations, sales, service training, executing through multiple distribution channels, and value proposition implementation. So welcome, Joel. I remember when we first met, it was through an introduction from one of our faculty member, attorney Colleen Carcone, who introduced us about a few months ago. And I have since been fascinated by your podcast. But before we get to your podcast, let's talk a little bit about, tell us where you grew up and how did you become interested in financial services industry?
So, to be mindful, I first of all, I want to just say thank you very much for having me here on your mentoring forum. So pretty excited about our conversation today. My background is kind of interesting. I would say in my younger years, I was actually focused on the toy industry. And during my studies, I started working in the financial industry and realized I was just dealing with big kids instead of small kids in terms of keeping people happy. And I think this also leads into behavior. So I would say over these years, I've been in these multiple roles from marketing strategy to content development, product development, training and development, improved customer service. But what I realized over this time is I've always been a facilitator. I've always been involved with telling stories. And regardless of the role, I've always been helping people through these stories understand the benefits of financial products, financial services, concepts, and as you said earlier, in a way that is relevant, engaging, and shareable. And had a very good career in that. But more recently, I hung up my hat, well, actually hung up my suit and tie, and focused more on financial literacy, because throughout my career, financial literacy has always been close to my heart. I've always, any type of volunteer events on the side and the like and the mentoring have always been about financial literacy. And with everything going on in the world today, I wanted to start something new to give back as much as I can and help others understand, especially about behavioral risks and how that impacts them. So I started Finn Wisdom. And so in addition to Finn Wisdom, I would say that, you know, I'm consulting, I'm writing a book, I work with people with content creation and e-learning modules and much more. But the concentration is in the foundation is this podcast. And the podcast is really focused on why you do what you do with your money. So each episode focuses on a behavioral risk, and each episode's about 20 minutes long or so to help you understand it and hopefully retain it. And so that you can do or understand how your behavior is impacting your financial decision making.
And you mentioned about the book that you're writing. Would you care to talk a little bit about what is your book about? I'm very excited to hear that, because when I was looking at your podcast, you have quite a bit of materials in the podcast area. So I'm curious about what is the book that's going to glue us to your stories, so to speak.
You know, I actually like that you said that. It is the glue. So the book focuses a lot of what's being mentioned in the podcast, and then some. A lot of the feedback I've received is, you know, people say, tell me more. And the book allows me to actually literally illustrate some of the concepts, expand on some of the stories. So a good basis is coming from the actual podcast. People were looking for reinforcement. And as you know, podcasts aren't for everyone. And so there's a whole other audience that I'd like to reach and have them understand these concepts. And in addition, so I've gotten pretty far through. I'm starting season 3 soon and incorporating those new stories as well as far, and as well as a few extra chapters to help round out the conversation. I don't want to give away the title yet. But I'm fairly through writing the first draft, so I'm pretty happy.
So in creating the stories, because you mentioned many times about your master of storytelling, would you give us an example in terms of how how do you intertwine stories into the message that you're trying to send to your audience? Right. For example, I think your podcast, you have something about obsessions with the professions and avoiding
obsessions with possessions. Yes.
Right. So could you walk us through in the constructing your stories? How do you effectively do that and not forgetting about the key message that you're trying to deliver to your audience?
So the reason often in the podcast I'll give actually a different example of a story that rather than the one I actually gave in the podcast around obsessions with possessions, because the idea is the only way you're going to understand about these behaviors is if you see it in yourself. And it's not just about financial decision-making. These are behaviors that you naturally respond to in other areas of your life. So let me give an example. So obsessions with possessions. So think about, have you ever played a board game like Monopoly, Clue, Risk, Sorry, any board game?
I'm terrible with any of them, but yes, I have played before.
But in every one of these board games, Charlie, there's always like these game pieces that represent you.
That's right.
So what happens is let's say with Monopoly, I always love to be the race car. Love being a race car. That's me. But you don't always get first dibs on those game pieces. And so if someone got my race car, and oh my gosh, if I got stuck with the thimble, that's it. But you know, when you think about the race car, and I really want it, and someone else has got it, you have this like sense of ownership. You don't really own it, but you give it this sense of ownership and you're frustrated the whole game. You could even win the game and you, but the whole game you're thinking about that other person who's doing it. And especially if you're playing Monopoly or some of the other games, you actually may do or commit a level of behavioral risk and treat that person a little less fairly than the rest of the people just because they're using your piece. So this kind of story gets you to understand that this sense of ownership, by the way, is it lends itself to a psychological influence called the endowment effect. So talking in terms of a story like that, that we can all relate to, and then you can ask yourself, okay, what's the endowment effect? And that's where you're basically attaching greater value to things that you believe you have ownership in. And this doesn't just stop with a game. I bet like in your office, there's a conference room that you always use for meetings. And if there's any, you know, individuals who are listening or listen to this podcast, the recording, who are students in your classroom, there is a chair that you always sit in that conference room. It, you always gravitate to it or in the classroom. What happened?
Okay. I have to stop you. It sounds like you know me so well. Yes, I do sit in the same chair. This is terrible. And even when driving, I drive the same route. Like it cannot change my route. So I totally agree to. So I can see how people can gravitate to your story. So sorry for cutting you off.
No, not at all. I'm but the point is, you know what, Charlie? Now tell me what happens when you walk into that room and someone is in your chair.
Well, then I get frustrated, you know,
yeah.
And I'm going to try doing everything to get that person off the chair.
It throws you off your game. It can even happen in your house. You have your favorite chair in the dining room table or in the living room, or, you know, you have guests over and they just happen to sit in your seat. Right. You don't say anything, but it changes your mindset. And so this kind of thing happens in the financial world, right? So how does an endowment effect impact your financial decision-making?
Well, can I share a story? Maybe we can walk.
Oh, yeah, please do.
So this is back in many, many moons ago. I used to work for a drinks company, right? They are the world's largest drinks company. And one year, that particular year, so grapes, I'm talking about wines. It's a little bit too early for me to talk about that at this point, but that particular year, I remember 1988, not the year that I bought that wine, but the year of 1988 happened to be a very, very dry season, and the grapes in the general Napa Valley was not good. And so 5 years forward, that red wine is ready to be on the market. So the company couldn't sell much of it because of the fact the grape was so bad. So guess what? They promoted to employees. I promise there's a point here. So fancy employees like me, like, oh, that's a great deal. The company I work for, right? That's not endowment, that's availability right there, right? Availability bias right there. The company must have a great product. Why on the earth that they are promoting to their employees? So I bought dozens. I mean, I even bought for my friends dozens, just to give you a little idea, the minivan that we have at the time. If you're looking in the back of our minivan, you can see the entire van is kind of tilted to one side because it was just way too heavy. So over the years, my husband has constantly asked me, hey, do you remember that you bought those wines? What happened to them? No, so just to give you an idea that the market price at the time of the purchase was roughly, let's say, $80 market price at the time, but was so marked down, I bought it for, let's say, $40 a bottle. So speaking of the endowment, so now you can see the ownership I attached to those wines till today. Right. Just assume I have three dozens on my possession. So this is about decades ago. Right. Three dozen in my possessions. Guess how many bottles I have drank so far?
I don't know. I'm afraid to ask.
Just one. And I didn't open it until last year. Can you believe it? I hold on to, I'm not even a collector. I'm not planning to sell it. But for some reason, I believe because I own these wines, the value must be going up. It is going up. It's not necessarily going up where I think it should be. If you Google that particular year of wine, it's worth about $140 or so. Now, a lot of students tell me that I should just have a party.
Yeah, you should just have a party. But maybe you have to use it as fruit punch or something.
No, these are hundreds of dollars wines. No, you cannot serve with fruit punch. No.
You know what? This is a really great lead into an example I was going to give anyway, which is great. I can't believe you almost align this. So when we talk about financial decision making and endowment effect. So let's take your kind of example, but let's talk about a stock that at the time seemed like it, with the information that you had, was appropriate and was really, it made sense.
Okay, so Joe, you just opened up a Pandora box for me. Let's go Twitter. That was my loser stock.
So, but at the time it seemed like the right thing. But that now, so but you own it now, right? So now it's in your portfolio. Right. And the question comes right. Then let's say things don't go the right way, whether there's market condition changes, geopolitical environment changes, maybe the business model changes, whatever it is, the stock is not doing so well. But this endowment effect makes you hesitate and you ask yourself, how low will it go until you're willing to get let go of it? And sometimes people have a really tough time and say, I want my money back on it. I'm going to wait until the stock price goes back to the price I bought it at, and then maybe I'll be willing to sell it.
Okay, what happened, and I think that's a very good point there. So the Twitter stock that I have, the reason I say is a loser stock, that's probably my number two loser stock. Number one, bankrupt. So anyway, I don't even remember the name of it. It's so many years ago. So the Twitter stock was going down, and I hold on to it for too long, and I should have sell it and just cut my loose, right? But instead, guess what? We financial experts think that we can dollar cost averaging. I start by, so this is, I think that you could say whatever you want to say about my behavior, but I wasn't really watching my endowment effect, right? I went and I say, well, let me buy the lower price. So I'm kind of averaging my costs a little bit, right? What I should have done is really just to cut loose. At the end, I did sell all the losing stocks, but I have a lot to lose because of that endowment effect.
So that's a really big one. I could give so many other examples of how this is occurring today, even in other purchases. You know what? If you're looking for buying a car, when you go into the sales room and you go out and you test drive the car, you get this feeling of ownership there. You know what? Even if you're not there, you know what's going on today. You could be saying, "Well, you know what, Joelle, I buy everything online. I'm not influenced that way." Well, even today's retailers, they have augmented reality, right? Oh, you want that lamp? Hey, just hold up your phone in your living room. Look, there's the lamp right there. It's giving you this sense of ownership right there. You see it in your room, and it makes it easier to make that purchase.
And so Joe, what you're really saying is that understanding our own behavioral biases, if you will. If you don't understand your own behavioral biases, all the marketer is doing to you, like it or not, because they are consciously doing that to you. Speaking of buying a car, should I go there? Probably not. I'll skip. I'll let you talk.
No, that's fine. So, you know, but that's the point, and that's what I like telling these stories. I think it's almost like when you have to admit yourself that you did something wrong, right? You almost have to laugh at yourself to get over and understand it. And, you know, you have on the screen right now about the what I use as a definition for behavioral economics. But before you can talk about behavioral economics, I feel like I have to take 60 seconds to talk about economic theory or neoclassic economic theory. And basically, so economic models are based on these three assumptions, right? Number one is that you know all your options and the probabilities assigned to them. Number two assumption is that you have 100% of the facts to make your decisions. And number three is you know the exact metrics or level of satisfaction from making any of those decisions. But we don't have all that. We don't have all those things to work on. You don't have all that information. So what happens is your mind does a shortcut called heuristics. And you use, and that's, you know, a combination of your experiences, the advice you receive, and maybe the research and information that you go out there. But the problem with this, and like, as you see on this slide, every decision is then is influenced by social, cognitive, and emotional factors. And so
I think one of the kind of a evolution, if you will, from the behavioral economics was at the time, economists always assume we people make rational decisions.
That's right.
Unfortunately, that's those right. Psychological and emotional side of things tend to make us do something weird. And so I think that this based on typical utility theories and move on to the prospect theories and things like that. But I think that one classical way of looking at the, from an economist perspective, and take prospect theory as an example, is I always love to use the Social Security retirement benefits claiming as an example, where I always tell people that, you know, the Social Security Administration is really smart. They are smart. They want you to claim early. They know what they're doing. They effectively insert that prospect theory in there, right? I think that one of the podcasts you talk about anchoring. You talked about how the employers anchoring your ability to save, right? And this is no different than Social Security Administration. They're saying that, listen, you can claim your Social Security as early as 62. So guess what? Statistically saying, majority of the retirees claim their Social Security at age 62.
Right.
They're not really actually doing us the favor. They are really just make things convenient for people, not necessarily trick people to take it early, but most people do not know that there is a discount, not to mention that most people really don't care about those discounts. What they think is they're losing the entire Social Security amount. Therefore, they have to grab it as early as possible.
And when they do that also, I mean, there's other risks that come into play, right? Like longevity risk.
Sure.
And if you do retire early, you know, there's a sequence of returns risk and the like. I agree with a lot of that. And the anchoring is really, I actually think anchoring is one of the most pivotal behavioral risks out there. You know, you talked about prospect theory.
Can you talk a little bit about what anchoring is?
Yes. So, you know, if I can, again, I always like to tell a little story. And this one, I think I used in the podcast. I'm not sure. But I've been living in Manhattan for over 25 years. And everyone you meet, and I've crisscrossed this country. I was actually doing the math the other day. I think there's only like 12 or 15 states I haven't been at too. And everywhere you go, someone or their family member have worked, visited, lived in New York City, right? And so people like to go, oh, I've been there. And if someone says, if you're going, you're like, you should see this, right? Oh my gosh, when I was there, I saw this play. I saw, you have to go see this particular museum exhibit, and you definitely have to go visit this restaurant. But as little as 5 years ago or whatever, that's anchoring, because today that play is no longer there. That restaurant may have moved. It's not there either. And that museum exhibit? Well, yeah, it's traveling. It's up in Toronto right now. It's not in New York City.